what you're doing is the same transmitter puts a voltage in the port number one, and then it reads the voltage and its phase coming out of port number two. And by the way, let me say something. Well, I'll get to that. I'm talking about active, like amplifiers in a moment. So what you do is you measure the voltage coming in at each frequency as it scans. So it gives you a display where the horizontal axis, like the other one, is frequency, and the vertical axis is, in the simplest sense, the gain. For ham radio work, we really don't care about the phase. We just want to know the gain. So I take my TVI filter. I find that the gain is flat. I start looking at 3 megahertz. I'm really interested in HF, so no point in going below that. And I'm not sure how low this nano DNA will go, but certainly 3 megahertz is good. And I have it scan up to about 100 megahertz. And I see it dead flat up to about 45 megahertz. Then it drops like 40 dB by 58 megahertz. And then from 58 to 100, there's a little bit of wobbling, but it's like 40 dB down. So you are attenuating harmonics in 50 to at least 100 megahertz band by 40 dB. Okay, I'm dropping. Just since I'm not getting any feedback at all, Roy, any comments? Am I going too fast, or are you following me?
No, you're going fine, Ed. I understand what you're saying, and I'm following you. I'm sure everyone's sitting there with rapt attention.
Now, let us take another case, an amplifier. You have to be careful using a vector network analyzer of any type for an amplifier, because it's the same thing as this filter, but it has gain. Here's the problem. The analyzer is designed to put out a couple of milliwatts. It's not expecting to get back in on port 2 more than a couple of milliwatts. So what you absolutely need is you have to know how much gain this amplifier can possibly give you, and follow it up with an equal and opposite attenuator to bring the output down to a level so you don't blow out the receiver on port 2. So as long as you do that, you're fine with amplifiers. And like I said, if you're working on a military radar transmitter, the government may want to know what the performance of this thing is going backwards, but hams don't care, so I'm not going to go into that. And you may want to get into phase shifts. Now, if you're building an amplifier, you phased array antenna, like a phased array radar antenna, where you're using electronic beam steering, you want to know exactly what phase shift you're getting through your amplifiers. But again, we're talking about a single channel. We don't really care about the phase. And I'm trying not to go down that rabbit hole, as I said before. On the other hand, if you call me on it, watch out, because I'll go down that rabbit hole with you. I'm trying to save you guys. In any event, so what you can do is a classic application of that. Those of you who are old enough to remember the old boat anchor radios, all the receivers had IF strips with IF cans. If you don't know what I'm talking about, a super heterodyne receiver has an intermediate frequency amplifier. I'm not going to go into that right now, but I can if anybody wants to know. And what you do is you have a lot of amplification at one frequency, and it is a very specific bandwidth. Like a single sideband, you want approximately a 2.7 kilohertz bandwidth. Morse code, you might want to have a choice of maybe 2.7 kilohertz for wide and 500 hertz for narrow. Well, when you have an old boat anchor receiver with vacuum tubes and IF cans and about 20 different little tweaks of inductors and capacitors in the IF cans, I mean, an IF can is typically an RF transformer with a little trimmer capacitor on the input and on the output. And only way you can align...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Roy, did I lose anything there?
No, you stopped when it timed out. Are you listening to yourself?
Negative. I guess that either just get good dead reckoning or blind luck. Hang on. What is that? So, let's see. So what you do is, if you want to align the IF amplifier with the IF cans, the Vector Network Analyzer is a fantastic device in the nano VNA. I think I know guys who, if I had a time machine, they'd say, just send me back the nano VNA so I can do my IF alignment. But what you do is you sweep the frequency. Let's say you have a 455 kilohertz IF, and you want 2.7 kilohertz with the proper, what they call skirts. Is, you know, at 2.7 you want it to be down, say, 2 dB, and you want it to be down 20 dB at 3.5 kc, and you want it to be down 20 dB at 4.5 kc. That's called a skirt. It's reminiscent of a woman's skirt, that like a trapezoid that flares out a little further down. Also, yeah, Paul might appreciate this. A lot of space vehicle launchers have skirts to flare at the bottom of the engine. So what you can do is you have a picture and you can just tweak all of the little adjustments and see one image in front of your face what's changing. And you can just play with it, go back and forth, and in fairly short order you can get the characteristic you want. And any other time, if you touch any of those old IF scan adjustments without a setup like this, you are going to mess it up horribly. Now, again, an IF amplifier has a lot of gain, so you may have to follow this up with some kind of a switch adjustable attenuator, which is like a box with a batch of switches and resistors that give you, you know, you can play and get the right attenuation. What you'd want to do is start at maximum attenuation and slowly reduce the attenuation until you get, you know, what you're looking for without going so high you're going to blow out the receiver. All right. I think that's where I plan to go with this. Any comments, questions, or anything? If not, Roy, I'd like to hear your thoughts.
WS2N.
Paul.
Is this one of these gadgets where you put batteries in there and, you know, you use it for a couple of times and you're changing them out? So, is this one of these things where they recommend the rechargeable batteries? Back to you.
The nano VNA has a lot in common with my cell phone. A, it's about the same size as a typical smartphone. B, it has a USB-C connector and a rechargeable battery, just like my smartphone. Does that answer your question?
Good. Very good. Back to you.
Anybody else have a comment?
Yeah, Ed, since you've used a bunch of vector network analyzers in the past, I'd be interested in how you see the nano VNA. I mean, it is great for its price, but it certainly shouldn't be the equal as far as dynamic range of multi-thousand dollar models quite yet. So have you found any technical set limitations of the nano VNA that you would prefer to have it magically be the same as a very expensive VNA?
Excellent question. Although I'm not quite going to go where you think I'm going to go, but let me answer where you're going first. I believe that for the kind of work that anybody listening to me at this point, who hasn't said, been there, done that, turned off the radio and walked away, nano VNA performance specs are excellent. They're all you're ever going to need. Like I said, when a company spends tens of thousands of dollars on a piece of equipment, that's because they have some very, very unique applications for a very, very unique customer. And I will say, you find these things a lot in secure labs in places that do highfalutin military work. If, however, you're talking about doing things like I mentioned, tuning an IF, measuring the SWR of an antenna, the nano DNA is fine. What I find is the big problem is it is really, really annoying to use. I find it basically has one just role. There is basically a little thing, it looks like a volume control dial, but it really has only two positions. You can click it down, or you can click it one click to the left, or one click to the right. And the menus come up on the screen, and all you can do is press it down or press it to the left. And I found pressing to the left or the right doesn't even matter. So you really have two switches. And it's really annoying to play with it. And I also find if you make a mistake, sometimes it just defaults back to power on. So I find it can be absolutely infuriating. And the fact that there is no official manual, and you can find stuff online that is just guys like me playing with it and writing it down, throwing it online. And I wish I had something a little more official. Now, let me give you an example. I told you I tested that old low-pass filter, anti-TBI, that gave you 40 dB of attenuation in the TV band for your HF transmitter. I cannot figure out why, and I must admit, maybe if I played with another few minutes, it's telling me in the pass band there's a 12 dB loss. And I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I think I just haven't figured out what I'm doing wrong. Does that answer the question, Roy?
Well, to a degree. It was my understanding that the dynamic range is not probably up to the job of, say, tuning a repeater's duplexer. So I was wondering if you found other similar things that any given ham might consider doing where the specs weren't quite up to snuff. Also, just as an aside, have you experimented with the P software that can enable remote access control so that you plug it into a USB port on a computer, the screen comes up on the computer, and you do all of the menus?
Have I ever shown such masochistic tendencies to you before? Why would I want to start now?
Okay, different strokes for different folks. I mean, that was one of the first things that I tried out of the box, is to look up whether there's, I think it's a Python software that someone came up with, and it's very, very functional. You know, I don't want to give you any extra jobs there, but, you know, I mean, if you ever look at my QRZ page, you kind of the idea of I'm very computer-centric. Even right now, I'm looking at a whole bunch of things on the screen.
I hear what you're saying, and let me give you a serious answer. I believe for me to do that would be an order of magnitude more work than I put in it to date. And I do not personally see benefit that I would personally get from that improved level of operation. I seem to be content for my own personal needs, the kind of stuff I've described. Now, coming back to your comment about tuning a repeated duplexer, I understand your point. On the other hand, I have no hands-on experience with that. And unfortunately, the last time I had to address the subject of tuning a repeated duplexer, I had access to a horribly over-designed unit, because this was with the Grumman Radio Club, which was located on Northrop Grumman property, where I had access to millions of dollars worth of test equipment. And the fellow in charge of that equipment, while not a ham himself, was a close friend of mine and knew a lot about ham radio. So it's a fascinating question. I'm going to take that as a homework assignment.
Okay, very good, Ed. In addition, I want to tell people that on my link page, one of the first links is a nice little article on introduction to VNA basics. for those people who want to read more on the subject. Also, Ed, did you want to say just a couple words about a scalar network analyzer? Unfortunately, I've bumped into the occasional electrical engineer who isn't quite sure what that is.
Neither am I. I think it's just an earlier, older version that does not play with phase.
Well, yeah, it's scalar, so as opposed to a vector, so all it gives you is an amplitude. It's of some use, occasionally if you Google scalar network analyzer, they still, I think, exist. The vector network analyzers are much better because they give you the directionality of the signal, the phase and the impedance, rather than just the amplitude. But, you know, it's always good to know things, because I heard many, many years ago on this repeater in the middle of the night, some guy mentioned the scalar network analyzers and had an interesting definition for them that didn't correlate with this known universe. So I just thought we could just touch on that for a second.
NY2H?
Yes, Lou?
Question for Ed. So when you did the bandpass for the filter, and you had a 12 dB loss in the bandpass area, did you do the user calibration, so-called user calibration, where it's supposed to take out any effects of the connectors and the cables that you might have used to connect that filter?
Let me put it this way. I have done the recommended calibration, but that seems to be the one-point calibration, where you go with a short, you go with an open, and then you go with 50 ohms. And that sets up the vector network analyzer to establish the high end, the low end, and exactly the target. I have not been able to find how you calibrate the two-port. Now, to calibrate the two-port, what you want to have is a nice, short, high-quality cable that will be close enough to 0 dB loss in the frequencies of interest that you can tell the network analyzer, all right, this is the ideal. This is 0 dB. Take your measurements and see where it goes from here. I have not found such a thing, and it's possible that I just have not found it yet, because the damn thing don't have a manual.
Ed?
You're right.
If you go to YouTube and you just type in nano VNA two-port, the very first thing that comes up is nano VNA correct two-port calibration.
Duly noted, but here's the point. I have no real specific reason to do that. I only did a little playing with it earlier today just to know enough for this conversation. And to tell you the truth, I think I've gotten the point across. I believe I told you when I recommended I might want to do this, I said I do not intend to get into the nitty-gritty of operating it. And I think we're getting down into that now. I think my point is to give everybody the basic idea, so if they want to pursue it, they know where to go and then they can play.
That right, 2H? Okay, that's understood, Ed. And we appreciate the presentation. From my point of view, I don't own one yet. I'd like to get one. And I guess I'm concerned about that 12 dB. That, you know, it could be mitigated. In other words, I doubt you suspect that that's a true reading, that there's a 12 dB loss inline in the filter at the frequencies you want to pass. So I will look at the videos that Roy recommended also, because my feeling is that the instrument, you know, can provide the accuracy that I would need. And I understand, you know, you don't want to get into it further, and that's fine. But I guess until proven otherwise, I think that
it should reflect, it's capable, let's say, of reflecting the actual loss figure in bands. So with that, turn it back to Ned.
Hang on, Lou, hang on. Lou, are you saying that you think you have such an application? In which case, I would be perfectly willing to look into that and do that and support you. My initial intention was just to be a little bit educational, but if you say you're really looking for more, I can support you and play with it some more and get back to you.
Well, Ed, right now it's just a curiosity. I do not have a specific application in mind, but I'm wondering, let me ask you this. That filter that you tested, is does it list what the loss should be in band? Or is that, sold?
I would figure under 1 dB maximum. Now, also, here's something. I am perfectly willing to accept this problem. I was just curious, what is the frequency response? And there I have every confidence at the point where it starts to roll off and how rapidly it rolls off. That's what I wanted to know. And that I have had answered to my absolute satisfaction. I am content to realize that this mystery 12 dB in band loss is something either it's not right or I'm not right. Much more likely I'm not right because I haven't taken the time to look into it, but I really found out what I wanted to know. So, I haven't really pursued it that far. I mean, obviously, if I had a specific reason to do so, it'd be a different ballgame.
So then, to summarize, I would say, just like a lot of us, you were interested in the skirt.
That could be misinterpreted, but yes.
All right, very good. NY2H.
All right, Lou, but because there is interest, if I get a chance, I have a little bit of a problem. I have some stuff coming up. I may not have the time to play with this for a week or so, but we'll see what happens. And maybe I'll come back on the on this net in a week or two with any follow-up. Roy?
KC2GX. Well, thank you so much, Ed. That was a great little talk on a subject that I hope is useful to other people. It was useful to me. I've had far less experience with two-port VNAs. My two previous VNAs were single-port devices. I have included, in addition to on my link page, Introduction to VNA Basic, I have included a link to the YouTube on how to correctly calibrate two ports of a nano VNA. If people are interested in vector network analyzers, I would suggest that they look up the subject. Unfortunately, it's like a treasure map. It's not like you can go to Amazon and buy a book that explains everything. There is no manual. It's all over the place. Go to references, go to websites, go to forum.ios, and you'll find all kinds of useful information. It is ridiculously inexpensive. I would suggest that you buy it from someone that you can return it to if it's faulty, and consider the different models, the slight variations. A bigger display is better than the smaller display, in my humble opinion, and N connectors are a bit more durable for me than SMA connectors. I assume, Ed, that you have the one that's an SMA connector.
All right, just put me here. Sorry for the space. Hope I'm making it. Yeah, I have the SMA, but I also was going to send a few bucks extra to get some little 6-inch cables to SO239 for the parallel of my hamster.
Okay, there are some companies that package a very, very nicely varied cable selection based upon the connectors of your nano VNA. I just find that the strain relief on the end connector is much stronger than SMA. But, you know, again, anyone out there interested in vector network analyzers, want to sweep their antennas at the very least, or do some more esoteric experiments, in my opinion, you can't go wrong. These things are under $100. You know, they're kind of like the Balfong of calibration equipment. Okay, unfortunately, I seem to have doubled with someone else. The person transmitting, could you repeat your ID? Yeah, AKHU, what's your comment?
I was listening about the idea to deal with dynamic range limitation video if it wasn't mentioned previously. Latest nano-VNA, the plus four, that's in the $200 bracket. It's not the $50 bracket, so there's that. Where some gentleman made 1.2 gigaplexer and compared the results with the Tektronix equipment, you know, price, gear, paired, and it was a long video, but basically it looked like it was doing pretty good with the notches, et cetera, for the duplex. That, you know, level, I think the latest one is out, so it's getting better, KB2A.
Don't forget, duplexes need like 100 dB of isolation.
Yeah, unfortunately, Ed, you doubled with KB2HHU, so I'll ask you to repeat yourself. Getting back to HHU, I saw that up on the queue. I haven't had a chance to see it. They had a similar one a year earlier with the previous version 2 that didn't have the dynamic range capable of really doing justice to a duplexer. So I'm happy to hear that a new model came out and that's coming closer. It's inevitable. But please, Ed, could you repeat yourself because you were doubling with the other gentleman?
I just made a quick comment that duplexers have like 100 dB of dynamic range, which is absolutely mind-boggling. Historically, I think what you've done is you've had to break them down into the subsections and independently test them. Because remember, you're putting 100 watts into duplex to transmit, and simultaneously 600 kilohertz away you are putting out a couple of microvolts into the receiver, and the two of them cannot interact or you blow up your receiver.
Yeah, I think the point of the people on YouTube was that was probably one of the most demanding uses for a VNA where inexpensive ones just couldn't quite supply the dynamic range. Most of the stuff that we do generally, it's immaterial whether you buy yourself a Rig Expert $1,000 VNA or a Nano VNA. You'll probably get about the same quality of reading. But with things like duplex tuning, as you mentioned, it requires a much more severe dynamic range that less expensive VNAs are often not quite designed for.
Well, that's true of so many things in life. As the performance goes up, the cost goes up to the third power.
Yes, indeed. And some people want the most expensive, shiniest thing, even though they're never going to really need something with those specifications. But for the rest of us, again, I think a Nano VNA is a great little toy to play with. I love mine. It sounds like you love yours. And, as people buy them and use them, if they want to come back on the TechNet and talk about it, that's great.
Oh, I have a cute, related but not directly story.
Certainly, Ed.
About 6 months ago, a friend of mine who's a member of Great South Bay Radio Club found out they were going to do a Zoom meeting with a talk on this very subject. And I made a point of tuning into it just to see. And the fellow, who by the way was not local to Long Island, he was like somewhere out in western Pennsylvania or something, which is the beauty of it. But in any event, he started by talking about SWR, because the DNA is very helpful measuring SWR, as I have mentioned. And then 45 minutes later, he was still talking about SWR and never even got to how to measure it on the DNA, when rather than throw my computer out the window, I turned it off and left.
Well, what can you do? Some people can't kind of laser focus into the subject at hand. They get stuck in a rabbit hole and go just farther and farther down. That's why just because a person knows the subject well doesn't necessarily mean that they can teach it well. Teaching is a linked talent, but not an exactly identical talent to the smarts of understanding concept.
I have an idea. Why don't you turn over the pole and you and I can take a break?
Sounds like a great idea, Ed. And once again, I want to thank you for this presentation. I enjoyed it immensely, and I'm sure that many, many people listening did as well. So I thank you for that. And now it's 10:19, more than enough time to summon Paul WS2N for the SpaceNet report.
Paul, don't take it personally. I'm abandoning you.
Okay, Ed. Have a good night if you're going to leave me. That's okay. AC2GS WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And about skirts on rockets, very important. If they need to, calm the wind down as the airflow as it goes up, they would have to install a skirt. Sometimes it's up high. I'm going to talk about one rocket tonight. That's going up that has to have a skirt on it to protect the payload, which is going to be the Starliner. Originally, they built it, they put it through a wind tunnel, and they didn't like the results, so they put a skirt up high coming off the service module off the, you have the very top, you have the spacecraft, the Starliner, and below that you have the service module, and now below that you have the skirt to compensate for what they saw in the wind tunnel, and that would be on the Atlas V rocket. Let me drop it. This is WS2N. Yeah, and that Starliner was supposed to go off this week, but now that's been delayed until Tuesday. And hopefully, I'm around. I'll put on NASA and watch that thing launch at 1:20 in the afternoon on Tuesday, August 3rd. And the reason that's important, it's going up as an unmanned vehicle, but eventually it will carry people. This is the one that they launched 2 Decembers ago, 2019. They launched the Starliner. The goal was to bring it to the International Space Station, dock with the space station, open the door, go inside, check everything out, make sure everything's okay, and then leave, and eventually a week or two later have it deorbit. Some parts of that whole thing I just described were very successful. The launch was successful and the landing was successful, but they weren't able to make it to the space station because they had computer problems. Computers weren't jiving with one another. The one that's in a capsule, with the other computers, it thought it had to be in a different location because the timing was off. Yeah, rocket started firing, bring it back to where it thought it should be, and they started going low on fuel, and they said, well, that's it, it's not going to make it to the space station, let's see how it lands. And, this was the first flight of this thing, and it landed perfectly. So certain parts of the test went well, but they need a complete test, and here we are over a year later testing it again. On their own, Boeing's paying for it. Boeing and Lockheed launch on the United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket, and what they call the 0-2-2 configuration. I mean, it's an Atlas V rocket, which is a big workhorse for NASA. They use the RD 180 engine, you know, as a booster, and then as the core, and then they have two solids attached to it, two solid booster rockets attached to it, and then when it launches, eventually that will drop off, and you'll have the final stage, which normally would have one engine, one liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engine, you know, called the RL-10, that's been around at probably 600 different launches over the years. They just upgraded them as the years went by, and instead of having one, they're going to have two on board. You know, it's a much heavier load than they normally would launch. So they normally have, you know, with normal launches, they just have the one engine. This one will have two on that final stage. So hopefully that goes off well on Tuesday. And if it does, it should take only one day to make it to the International Space Station. Next day would be Wednesday for docking. It'll dock, and then they'll check everything out, make sure everything's okay, leak test everything, and then open the door, and you'll see some crew members, the seven people on board the space station. You'll see some of them go inside the new Starliner. And if all goes okay, after unloading, and they'll only be able to bring maybe about 400 pounds worth of stuff up. Normally, they bring thousands of, you know, thousands of pounds, 6,000 or 7,000, 10,000 pounds sometimes of our equipment up to the space station. But in this case, they're only bringing around 400 pounds, which would be normal. If you would have a normal crew of four, you would normally bring up about 400 pounds of extra material. But this is a test for that vehicle. They'll undock at some point, and they'll duplicate what they did 2 Decembers ago. Land back in New Mexico, White Sands, New Mexico specifically. They'll send it down, heat shield, parachutes, heat shield will separate, and then that will expose these six that will eventually pop out that lift, you know, right before it lands, and it will land on those airbags. And the second it hits, the airbags actually start deflating, and that's how they're able to land softly. Didn't do that, it would be too much of a rough ride, but when they hit, they start deflating. Before I move on, let me drop it and see if there's any questions. This is WS2N. I just put on my fan for the radio. Usually I do that. Anytime I go on and on, it tends to heat up. Right now it's doing good. So, okay, and then there's going to be another couple of launches in the not-too-distant future. One in particular, Lucy, and that would be in October. Lucy will eventually go to the asteroid belt. Okay. Got my computer here. Not good. I have to change the settings. This is a new computer. Change the timing. Apparently, it decided to go off on me. Anyway, the main news for last week was this extra module that Russia sent up to the International Space Station called, it's actually called Fine. The Russian word is Nyoka. Nyoka is, you know, was sent up from Kazakhstan by Russia, and the idea was to have this thing eventually docked to the International Space Station, which actually it finally did, but it had some problems right at the launch. It had propulsion problems. The thrusters were sputtering. Kurs antenna, which they used for docking to the space station, that wouldn't unfurl, and that fine did. The solar panels worked, that opened up okay. After working out the problems, Russia straightened that out. It took before it docked with the space station. Before it did, what happened was they noticed they had some more thruster problems, and they had communication problems with the telemetry between the space station and the SERV and the module itself. But eventually, they figured, okay, we'll get it in close. Everything looks good. Let's dock it. So they docked this 43-foot long thing, 15 feet in diameter, weighs 20 tons. I put a picture of it on Roy's website, where he put it up there for me. It's a picture taken actually by a ham, Shane Kimbrough. Right away they want to take pictures. He took a picture of it, sent it down. Everything looks good. And then 3 hours later, actually the Russians were about to open up the door, the hatch to go inside. Next thing you know, the Nayuku had thrusters on it, started firing indiscriminately. And, if that keeps up for too long, you're going to wind up with an out-of-control space station. Like I said, the weight of this thing is 20 tons, which is about 1/20th of the weight of the whole space station. So this new module that contains a new crew quarters, bathroom, for creating oxygen. They take the water and they create oxygen out of all kinds of gadgets. It's a science lab. It's a very big lab. Was, all of a sudden firing these rockets for, the thrusters for unknown reason. Now the pitch of the whole space station is starting to change. They said the astronaut's going to feel it, but next thing you know, it keeps creeping up higher and higher. It's about 45 degrees higher than it should be. As the space station goes around, it stays level with the Earth. It's actually making one complete orbit around itself, but, 16 day, it makes 16 orbits every day. But, they have to keep, the down part of the space station facing Earth, and that wasn't happening. It was starting to change. So the space station starts to react. If the gyros start to feel change, they start to compensate. On the space station, they have these big, they're called moment gyros. They spin at maybe a couple of thousand RPMs, and each one is about 600 pounds. And that's what keeps the station steady. They don't change the speed of these constant motion. And, if there's any change of the space station as it orbits the Earth, this thing always keeps it exactly where it's supposed to be. Well, thrusters were pushing so hard that it was, the main gyros couldn't compensate that normally keeps the space station steady. What happened was that brought on another set of thrusters from another service module, another Russian module called Zvezda, which is as big as this other one that was just sent up. And those thrusters start pushing the whole space station in the other direction. And that wasn't good enough. Eventually, another set of thrusters from the Progress vehicle starts firing. And, they called it a tug of war. And anyway, it took about an hour to straighten this whole mess out. By the time they were able to shut down the misfiring thrusters inside of Nayuka. Nayuka was acting up. Apparently Russia was able to send signals, or either that or the crew did, to eventually shut these things off. Eventually they're going to go inside and try to poke around and straighten things out. As it was, to completely get this module up and running, there's going to be a lot of spacewalks. They have to hook up data cables, power cables, all kinds of things on the outside. They want to hook up a robotic arm, and it's going to take about 11 Russian spacewalks to do that. And that's without any problems. Now they have problems. So anyway, that's why the Starliner that I talked about earlier was supposed to launch the other day, but they scrubbed that mission until they figure out what's wrong with this Nyoka module. When they get the okay, they know 100% that these rocket engines aren't going to start firing again for some unknown reason. They were going to give the okay for Starliner. Right now, Starliner will launch, like I said, Tuesday at 1:20. See how that goes. Any questions, comments? This is WS2X.
NY2H.
Hi, Lou. Go ahead. NY2H, WS2M.
Yeah, hi, Paul. Three questions. First one is, has the attitude been corrected now and back to nominal? That's my first question. Second question is, with this tug of war, imagine a lot of fuel was consumed. So are they low on fuel because of that? And my third question is, the source of fuel, can these thrusters share common fuel supply, or is each one independent?
Okay, the last question first. They have, like, Progress, that's a cargo vehicle that docks at the space station. They have the capability of transferring fuel to Zesda. That's the main module that normally uses its thrusters to push the space station to a higher elevation. Over time, the elevation drops. And then, every time they have a chance, they used to do it with the shuttle. They've done it with the Cygnus cargo vehicle. Anytime there's a vehicle up there with fuel in it, they'll always accelerate the space station to a higher level. So Progress and Zesda has that capability. This one, I don't know if it has that capability to interchange fuel. I don't think so with the other ones. And they use fuel, but they have a lot of fuel on board. In fact, on a regular basis, once in a while you'll see a Progress cargo vehicle go up there. Instead of having clothes and food and stuff, they'll actually carry fuel on it. That's the main source. And they'll open up the valves, and the valves will flow into the Zesda service module and refuel that thing. So they have, they have the capability. And from what I read, they did not use up all that much fuel. I mean, you could fly these rockets for, literally an hour and have no problem. Tremendous amount of fuel inside. Probably you could go up there. These were firing for, maybe minutes at a time. Like they said, on and off, they were, like when they came on, they would go off and come back on again. Some kind of a problem. And then, let's see, there was a third question. Back to you, Lou.
Yes. Are they back to a nominal attitude?
Yes, they zeroed it back out. They got as far as 45 degrees out, and they were changing around half a degree a second, they said, when they were having a problem. For those gyros, not to fix things up, the center of the space station, they have these, Z1 truss section, and that has the gyros located in it. And there's four of them. For these things not to, not to be able to compensate for it, it's pretty amazing. They have thousands of pounds of force on these things. They're not reaction wheels. These are, spinning gyros. They have the capability of turning the whole space station, in three different directions: pitch, yaw, and roll. These things not to be able to compensate. They were fighting it, but not good enough. And eventually it gets to the point where they start, the gyros turn on their axes, and eventually they'll be parallel to one another. And they call that saturation. So I'm sure they they probably have to, you know, go through what they consider a, you know, unsaturating thing. They'll fire at certain thrusters to actually force it back to where it's supposed to be, and then eventually they'll be able to correct these, all the gyros. I'm sure they've done that by now, but I haven't read that there's a problem. So everything is squared away. Just don't know why this is happening. It's a very old vehicle, even though it's new to the space station. Started building it around 12 years ago. It's a duplicate of the service module. It's up there, the Russian service module. Again, 43 feet long, 15 feet in diameter, and roughly 20 tons. So it's a duplicate of that. They were building it as, you know, as a backup in case it, you know, when they launched the first one over 20 years ago now, 1998. That didn't work. This one was going to replace it. They kept it in storage. And the years went by, and Russia has money problems, and they were supposed to launch this thing, you know, many years ago, and that didn't happen. Then as time went on, the piping and everything starts to actually degrade. The valves and the piping, you know, they're only guaranteed for a certain period of time with fuel in it, inside of it, so they defueled it and actually repiped it over the years. So, you know, it's like a renovation job. Finally got it all back together. Then they were supposed to launch a couple of years ago. And then they were supposed to launch last year, and COVID came up, and that slowed things down. They finally got it off the ground. But, you know, but it adds a lot more room to space station. And now, about, I guess, about 15 different modules. Any other questions, comments? This is WS Collect. Okay. I wanted to talk about China for a second. Not much, but a little bit where reusability is very important. We have SpaceX, and they've recaptured almost 90 of these boosters, either on land or on the drone ships. And it's driving the cost of launching rockets way down. Now you have the Electron rocket being built by Rocket Lab, Peter Beck, and he's trying to do the same thing with his rockets, coming down in parachutes, landing in the water, and eventually he's going to try to relaunch them. And then eventually that same company wants to have a reusable rocket much bigger than Electron, maybe five times bigger. That's going to be called the Neutron rocket, and that will land on a drone ship as well. We have a lot of American companies, including Jeff Bezos, with Blue Origin. Blue Origin is building the New Glenn rocket that will, if you match it up against the Saturn V, it's almost as tall as that thing. But when that thing starts launching in early 2022, that will be landing on a drone ship as well. So now China, they see the handwriting on the wall. They have at least three companies now experimenting with, they call it VTBL, vertical takeoff, vertical landing systems. I did see one prototype. They're very small, but, you know, they copy everything from us. The legs look like the same legs, very similar legs to SpaceX on their Falcon 9 rocket. So that's the wave of the future. Other outfits like European Space Agency, they would like to do this eventually with, you know, at least save the engines on their new Ariane 6 rocket that will be probably be first launch maybe next year. So that should be interesting. Let me drop it. So, you know, I keep a watch on China. You know, Russia, I'm not too worried about too much anymore. All kinds of financial problems, and you know, they have political problems. They put a political oligarch in charge of their Roscosmos, which is equivalent to our NASA. And ever since he's been in charge, they've had all kinds of problems, holes in spacecraft, you know, attached to the space station, leaking air out, and a couple of other weird things that have gone on with them. We had two astronauts going up a couple of years ago. He was going up with another Russian, two guys. They wound up aborting. As they were flying in space, they had to abort and come back. So the boosters separated and then twisted around and hit the core stage, almost killed those two guys. And all kinds of problems with this Russian group that's in charge. And now this, talking about patching this thing for the last 12 years, they finally get the thing patched, and they have all kinds of problems. So, not worried about them. I'm worried about China. They're riding around on Mars with a rover right now, solar powered. They have another rover riding around on the dark side of the moon, the U-2 rover. They have a space station now in orbit with three people on board. They plan on expanding that. They have one big module, and they're going to be sending up two more modules equal in size in the near future. And, they have dreams of getting to the moon. I joked years ago, I used to joke around, last thing I need to see is, a Chinese lander on the moon, putting a new battery in one of our rovers that are sitting up there. We have three rovers that are still sitting on the moon, one from Apollo 15, one from Apollo 16, one from Apollo 17, but not too far from the truth. We're getting there. We have somewhat of a plan now to get to the moon, and hopefully that comes about. Any questions or comments? WS2M. Okay. Talking about the Electron rocket that did get off the ground recently. They've been grounded for a couple of months. That rocket did have a problem. Apparently, they have figured it out. Apparently the ignition system inside of it, the second stage, was radio interference. The computer on board, computer read it as a problem and shut the engine down prematurely, and they lost that flight. So now they're back in operation. Now this flight was supposed to be launched from American soil. Electron is launched from New Zealand, the North Island. Got a launch complex set up there. I mean, this is an American company. He's licensed out of California. But launches from New Zealand. He himself, when I say he, Beatback, is from New Zealand. Set up this Mars complex there and launches his Electron rocket from New Zealand. But he's also set up a launch pad here in the States, in Virginia, in Wallops Island. His fleet launched from it right now. But because of bureaucracy, FAA actually will not let him launch for a little while. And the reason they won't let him launch from Wallops Island is because the rockets have automatic detonation systems. Years ago, not too long ago, they still do it with a lot of the rockets. But SpaceX now has an automatic detonation system, and now this company does. When a rocket goes up, and you don't have to have somebody sitting there with a red button, push the explosion button. You don't need that anymore. These things will blow up if they go off course. If they're designed to go on 28 degrees inclination and they're going up to 50 degrees or something, they'll blow up all by themselves. And the FDA just, has not signed off on that part of it yet. So he's waiting to do that. He was supposed to launch last month payload for Spacewalks. They had a contract with Rocket Lab to do that on their Electron rocket. But they needed to go up, yesterday, so he said, okay, still launch it out of New Zealand. I could still launch out of there, which he did. And that had successfully went into orbit for for the United States Space Force. Any questions? Okay. I don't know if anybody read about Jeff Bezos trying to give NASA $1 billion. He wanted to hand over $2 billion. As long as he became part of the contract bid of the HLS system, HLS, Human Landing System. NASA has plans of eventually landing people on the moon. Most of the steps are complete. They plan on launching, four astronauts from Florida. Launch Complex 39B. Plan on doing that on an Orion spacecraft on top. That's going to be on top of the SLS Space Launch System development for since before the shuttle was shut down. Anyway, that's ready to go. The SLS inside the vehicle assembly building in Florida. They've already attached the solid boosters to the core stage, and I think pretty much all they have to do is put the second stage on top, eventually put the Orion spacecraft on top of that, along with the escape mechanism, and eventually they'll be able to launch this thing probably as early as December. Red Dick will likely early next year, and that will go to the moon without a crew, and then orbit the moon, and then come back and land in the Pacific Ocean. And then if that goes well, they will put a crew on it next time, maybe a year later. And that crew would also go into orbit, come back, and then land in the Pacific Ocean, not land on the moon. Right after that, using the same space launch system and the Orion spacecraft, will be the one that they plan on landing on the moon. That's the present plan right now. There is another plan to now get from orbit around the moon. The Orion spacecraft does not have legs. It'll go around the moon just like Apollo did. And they eventually want to transfer a crew from there to a landing vehicle. And now three companies were involved in developing the landers that would land up to four people in time or more onto the moon. One of them is SpaceX, another one is Blue Origin, and another one was Dianetics. And they were all hoping to get a piece of the pie. They thought there were going to be at least two chosen by NASA, two out of three. But NASA said, well, we're just going to go with SpaceX. So Jeff Bezos from Blue Origin was not happy. They put a lawsuit in. That went off, through the proper procedures, and eventually Jeff Bezos lost. But in the meantime, he planned on giving NASA $2 billion. If you pick us, we'll give you an extra $2 billion to be part of this group. This way they have SpaceX and them. But NASA said, no, we're not going to do that. We did it right with the amount of money that we had from the government. NASA gets around a little over $20 billion per year from the government, from the taxpayer. And they said, we're out of money here, so this is what we're going to do. Only one contract. But now with this thing that the government is trying to pass, this infrastructure deal, $1 trillion of, countless amount of money that's eventually going to be put towards roads and trains and all of that, NASA is hoping to get a small piece of that pie, a couple of $1 billion. Now, if that happens, it looks like they probably will eventually pick another contractor to develop a lander. And this is all being handled by Bill Nelson, who's now NASA Administrator. So that's more or less the word from Nelson on roughly their plans. I'd like to see at least two contractors available to do that work. For a number of reasons, you know, you might send a crew down on a SpaceX vehicle. You know, one of the flights, hopefully it's not the first one, but, you know, they're going to be doing this on a regular basis. And something goes wrong with that vehicle where they can't launch. You wouldn't want to send an identical vehicle down to bring them back up. Maybe that, you know, it's something that's germane to that vehicle. You would want to send maybe a completely different vehicle down, like what Dynamics was developing or what Blue Origin has developed. You know, send that vehicle down. And even if you're not doing a rescue mission, you know, you would want to switch on and off. You would want that. I mean, they did that with the cargo system, with sending cargo up to the International Space Station. You have the Dragon vehicle that brings cargo up. You have the Antares launches Cygnus, which is all built by Northrop Grumman to bring cargo to the space station. You have the Russians sending cargo. At one time, we had the European Space Agency sending the ATV, the automatic transit vehicle, to the International Space Station with cargo. You have Cygnus now going, you know, on a regular basis. You have all these, you know, backup after backup, which is very good. You have another one called Dream Chaser, which is probably going to be ready within a couple of years to also send cargo to the space station. And crew. Now you have crew, this third crew that has gone up to the space station by a Dragon SpaceX vehicle. And now you're going to have another crew vehicle called Starliner, which will be tested out this Tuesday to go up to the International Space Station. By the way, if that all works out, the next flight will have a crew of three. They're sending three on that first flight. After that will be four to the base station, and that will probably launch early next year. Any questions or comments? This is WS2X. Nothing heard. I've gotten to the end of the line here. I'm looking at the clock anyway. It's around 11 o'clock. That we're going to turn it over to Roy. I hope to be on tomorrow night during the club InfoNet, which anybody can check into. You know, I have to be a club member. And they'll have this swap and shop after that. And that's always followed by Newsline. That's always interesting. Find out what's going on in the world of amateur radio. But now I'm going to turn it over to Roy, AC2GS, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet.
AC2GS, thank you so much, Paul, for all you do for the SpaceNet report. I really appreciate it. And as well, thanks to everyone who participated tonight. Thanks to Ed with that wonderful discussion of two-port vector network analyzers. I enjoyed that as well. And I appreciated all the people that participated in all the sundry threads of topics that we discoursed upon tonight. As always, want to remind people that if you want to reach me, you can do it via radio. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Link page has all kinds of interesting links in addition to the basics of vector network analyzers and how to calibrate a nano-VNA two-port analyzer. There's a whole bunch of other articles that might interest you, so please check them on my link page, which is roy.ac2s.com. Want to remind people that I keep a audio stream of the Glen Oaks repeater almost 24/7. Just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you the audio stream if you're away from the radio. And always keep in mind, Mike, KC2NJI's amateurradio.tv. It's a wonderful source for archives of the technical net that go as far back as September of 2006. Dick used to end these, the technical nets, with a variation of very good advice. Be kind to each other. This has always been good advice and is especially apropos during our time here with COVID-19. It's not over yet, but hopefully we've seen the worst of it and we will get out from under it. Please, if you have friends or family that should be vaccinated, urge them to be vaccinated. be safe and be well. And hopefully come back next Sunday night at 8 o'clock when we'll try and do this all over again. So I wish you all well. And this is AC2GS, and I'll be going clear. And this formally closes this episode of the Limark Technical Net.
Thank you very much, Roy, for all you do, NY2H.
Thank you, Lou.
Lou, NY2H, WS2, I have one comment.
Yeah, Paul.
Canoe, we had to sink it. I remember doing that in the Boy Scouts. If you wanted to go for the merit badge, canoeing merit badge, you had to sink it, take your shirt, your pants, tie it around the canoe, and it was completely submerged, water completely inside of it. And then, you went out with two people. So, you had two people in the canoe. And then you have to flip the canoe, you're treading water, flip the canoe where it's upside down in the water, that gets all the water out, then flip it again, and now it's, of course, floating in the water. The one guy stays on one side of the canoe, the other guy stays on the other, one guy climbs in, and the other guy climbs in. I remember going through that. Back to you.
That's exactly what we did. It was my brother-in-law and I in Delaware, and they rented us an aluminum canoe made by Grumman, the Grumman canoe. And, I kind of remembered we filled it with water. We completely, let it fill with water. Yeah, we had to tread water, the whole thing. And once you did that, then you were good to go. But they were making sure that you could handle that. And, he was in the back, I was in the front, and, it was fun. It was a lot of fun. A little white water, enough rocks there. I know that they rate these rivers, in terms of severity, et cetera, but this was okay. It was fun. I was in the front. He had more control in the back, which is what he wanted. He was younger than me at the time and still is, so... But it was a good time. But yeah, as you recounted it now, it all comes back to me.
I could discuss this for hours, Luke.
Different strokes, a couple of different strokes. Yeah, you hope this is the Boy Scouts, so you hope you're going to, you have a good partner to go out there with, And then if you made it, both people would get the canoeing merit badge. Yeah, a lot of fun. And that was Delaware as well. 10 mile, was it 10 mile line? Yeah. So, and I'm trying to think of the year. It had to be, early 1960s.
Wait a minute, Lou.
Yeah, mine was probably late 70s or early 80s. There was another station here they didn't get you. Go ahead.
WB2EAV.
Oh, hi, Ed.
I never did as a kid, but I did it maybe a dozen times since 1995 to around 2014. And I did it many times, many of them with my son when he was in the Boy Scouts. Yeah, I know all the drill, know all the stuff with the merit badge and everything. Absolutely. But what I was referring to was my fear of getting caught, going over, and just doing a belly whop into the river, possibly on top of rocks. Not any of the stuff you guys were discussing.
Yeah, you were concerned with the actual course. Sure. I guess that's the danger, the thrill, whatever.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to. But yeah, I know all that stuff. And I'm still active in the Boy Scouts. As a matter of fact, I spent... A couple of weeks ago, I was a week up in the Boy Scouts, onto Europe, if that means anything to you. And the possibility, although remote, I maybe needed to go back for a few days to a different one next week.
Okay, so the vagaries of our system, I think somebody was on the East End asking you a question, Ed. You probably doubled. Want the station pick it up again.
KD2VHD, Jim.
Good, Jim.
Ed, I'm curious. Your fear of that probably had more to do with your fear of the kids you were with than yourself. I know that's what my experience was. Any comments?
Normally, I agree with you 100%, but in that case, no, it was physical fear. I was afraid, you know, if you go over in the rapids, you don't always get a chance to pick the spot. And you can go flying into the water in a batch of rocks. And that part of the Delaware, you have rocks above and below the surface. And I was worried about physically hurting myself. And the doctor said, been there, done that, and I was black and blue for weeks. So it ain't a phobia. But normally, I agree with you 100%. But that was the exception.
Fair enough. Thanks for your answer.
And by the way, you know what take the sweep is?
Repeat.
Take the sweep, I'm sorry. T-A-K-E. The S-W-E-E-P.
I don't recall that one.
Taking the sweep is the second best person leads the best person tail end Charlie, because he's the one, he takes the sweep. He's got the broom to clean up all the messes he comes across. That's where I normally am.
Well, you're pretty good then, because I didn't have that position in canoeing, but I've had it in other pursuits. It was loads of fun. Boy Scout canoeing was a blast.
Yeah, I never grew up. I'm still doing that. Oh, I haven't done the canoeing in a few years, but I do a lot of the other stuff.
I've heard you speak of it. I miss it myself. It was good stuff. Saddest phrase I always hear is when people say, we used to do this in scouts, and I'm like, well, why don't you still do it?
Let me tell you a secret. That trip, I would usually take the back, my son would take the front, and we were a team. And I believe that was the best binding experience we ever had that led to this day, my 36-year-old son is my best friend.
That's awesome. I wasn't that successful, but I was close. That takes the cake, though.
Troy still listening? Guess not. All right, guys.
And thanks for your presentation tonight. It was informative. KD2B listening.
Hold on. I would like a more detailed review, you know, feedback, just for my own curiosity.
I guess my biggest wonder is I'm a guy who hasn't worked an oscilloscope in 35 years. I passed the general by the skin of my teeth. I'm trying to figure out how to set up some more centerfed dipoles. I don't know if I can make that machine work. It's a little witch doctor to me. What do you think?
I have an answer for you. It depends how badly you want to do it. It is a pain in the butt. There's no two ways about it. I mean, that's my biggest complaint about it. It is not that user-friendly. But if you really feel you have a use for it and or you want to do it, I am confident you will do it. That's one thing you learn in the Boy Scouts, isn't it? On the other hand, if you don't see any need for it, you'll never go that far.
That leaves me still uncertain. I find myself in the center of the ham radio stuff as a hobby and as a curiosity, and on the other side as a utility that is gaining more credibility every day. So I'm in the middle of that thought process. I still have an answer to that. I think I might go for the more simple traditional route, you know, a Buha meter and a wing and a prayer.
Oh, wait. I agree with that 1,000%. No, the nano VNA is a toy. Want to go with like an SWR meter and the like. Absolutely. When you are in the hobby is where I was as a teenager. So we're coming at it from very different places, but the difference is I have mentored enough hams to tell you, no, you are in the learning phase. And I, for one, and just about anybody else around here, is perfectly willing to support you in any questions you have, any assistance you need, okay?
Sure, appreciate it and understood. I had a feeling you would see it from that angle. That clarifies it for me a lot. Thank you.
And if you want to upgrade, the group I am, who I lead with DE exams, we actually have our testing venue back. So if you want to upgrade, we can accommodate you.
I'd like to, but I think it's a stretch for me at the moment. I've been thinking about it this week, about if I should be trying. I like the capabilities that the X-Trip provides. But my electronics background is old and crusty, and my ham knowledge is new and green.
As a doctor, I prescribe you learning by doing. Get on the air and play.
I'll be compliant with that. So far, so good.
And you said center fed dipoles. They're a lot of fun to play with. My comment to all the dudes, if you want to get on HF, just throw up a 40-meter dipole, 33 feet on the side, slap something together, the cheapest garbage you can find, will get out, and then just get on the air and play, and maybe in a couple of years you'll decide what tenor you really want, but at least you're on the air. I know too many people read all the data sheets and are paralyzed and never do anything.
Well, it's funny, I'm sitting in my garage / shack, and right outside it is exactly what you just described.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going around. That's why I said it. I know too many people like that, so I can add you to one more, you know, one more on my list. Throw up a 40-meter dipole. You can get on 40, you can get on 15 as a freebie, any kind of a decent antenna tuner, SWR bridge, you can put it on 20. Unless you have a reason, I advise you to stay away from 80 and 10, and that pretty much and all the other stuff. 40, 20, and 15, I would recommend, and you can do them all with a 40-meter dipole, and with antenna tuner, if you need the antenna tuner for 20.
No, I think you misunderstood what I said. I have exactly what you described right now. I've got a 40-meter dipole up right next to the garage. I've been playing around on 40. I don't have a ballon, I don't have anything, just a 40-meter dipole and a coax. It gets a beautiful SWR and an old ICOM 706, and I'm working it, I'm learning.
All right, you want to hear my take on balance? You may want to fasten your seatbelt, this is going to be a bumpy ride.
Oh, I love it, because it's confusing the hell out of me.
NY2H.
I'll wait for Luke, go ahead.
Yep, well, I was going to mention that you started this whole QSO and to get back to you, but I guess you're taking off.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I'm going to take off. I'll probably listen to Ed for a minute or two after I sign, but, you know, he's right about the dipole. I got two dipoles. I've been doing this for decades. I love the dipoles. Back to you, Lou, and I'm going to say 73. Catch you later.
All right, very good, Paul. Yeah, I appreciate the recounting of the canoe prep, so that was good. And, Ed, before I turn it back to you, I want you to know I did read the poem that you suggested today. I read the poem. I must tell you, it was ended up pretty violently. but anyway, I did read it, and apparently the woman shared my name, so I wasn't too happy about that, but anyway... Ed?
Lady that's known as Luke.
You got it.
So that is a classic. You know, a bunch of the boys were whooping up in the Malamute Saloon.
Yeah, the Malamute. And he bought everybody drinks. And his was, I think it was green or something.
I've had to do things like read Shakespeare's sonnets. After a bit of Shakespeare's sonnets, I have to decompress with Robert W. Service.
Yes, an Englishman. All right, I'm going to listen out. You guys continue. Talk about balance, and we'll be monitoring. This is NY2H, clear but listening. So, Ed, why don't you take it?
Okay, I forget the name. KD2Y, whatever. What's the name again?
It's Jim, KD2VHD. Kilo Delta 2 Victor Hotel Delta, or I prefer it as Kiln Drive 2 Volt Heavy Duty.
All right, that's a good one. All right, I have a question for you. Choose one, A or B. A, to have a 40-meter dipole up against the side of the house, probably next to the rain gutters and some siding and running through some trees, or B, you're building a phased array military radar antenna. Which one, A or B?
Neither. But I do have a decent-sized property. Not huge, but decent. And I got a 40-meter dipole between two trees, fairly in the clear.
All right, well, here's my take, and you do with it what you will. A balance keeps the feed line from radiating, so your antenna pattern matches the textbook example of a dipole, which is basically you take a donut, slide it down the wire, and that is a radiation pattern. What happens is without a balance, your feed line will distort the pattern, so it isn't totally symmetrical. If you're doing B and you're building a large phased array radar antenna, pattern is everything. You absolutely positively use the balance. You want classical textbook patterns so that the phases add in the proper sequence.